What?
I know how we can run everybody out of Rock Ridge.
How?
We'll kill the firstborn male child in every household.
Too Jewish.
Shalom, and welcome to the Too Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning on Too Jewish is Ron Lieber, your money columnist for the New York Times, and the author of the best-selling new book, The Opposite of Spoiled, Raising Kids Who Are Grounded, Generous, and Smart About Money. We'll also have visits from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, our Too Jewish maven on Israel, Oshrat Barel, and our maven on Jewish education, John Ben Asher. Please email your comments to us at TooJewishRadio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at TooJewishRadio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Too Jewish.
Shalom. The wonderful, ridiculous, purely fun holiday of Purim arrives this week. We're celebrating at my own congregation this very morning. And for most people, it's a kind of children's festival. Light, silly, frivolous, and appropriate for the springtime of the year and the springtime of life. But the truth is that the Book of Esther in the Bible, upon which the holiday of Purim is based, is a much darker and more complex tale than we give it credit for being. In fact, it details an attempted genocide against the Jews by an Iranian leader. This might sound kind of contemporary to many of you, and only a clever, highly manipulative effort by well-placed Jews manages to save our people from annihilation. We play it all for laughs on Purim. Truly, it's gallows humor, but it raises important issues of religious and personal identity, cultural and religious pride, assimilation, and values in a meaningful way. While we tend to think of Purim as a time to cheer for the Jewish heroes Mordechai and Esther, boo the wicked Haman, eat delicious Hamantaschen pastries, and have a drink or two to celebrate it all, the Megillah is actually the story of deep political intrigue, huge egos, superficial beauty contests, racism, sexism, outrageous threats, hairstyles, and scapegoating the helpless. In other words, it looks a lot like the 2016 campaign for President of the United States. Purim may be set in the Persian Empire of the 5th century BCE, but it's about as relevant today as it ever has been. There are additional elements to the Megillat Esther that are particularly appropriate now. Intermarriage plays a central role in the narrative. The intermarriage of a young Jewish girl with a wealthy, powerful Persian ruler is celebrated rather than criticized, and it ultimately saves the Jewish people. Without Esther's marriage to Ahasuerus, the Jews would have all been slaughtered, so you can easily read this as a pro-intermarriage text. Mind you, this is not some reform movement position paper from 2016. It's a book in the Jewish Bible, the Tanakh, and it's perhaps 2,400 years old. Not quite what we expect to see and hear, nor the lesson we've been taught over the years by our tradition. Most interestingly, God is not even mentioned in the Book of Esther, and God plays, at best, a minor role in the whole festival. It is human beings, Jewish men and Jewish women, who redirect history and save the Jews. And they do so by acting rapidly when needed, by making a strong commitment to their own people, and frankly, by working through and around the political system to achieve positive results. For American Jews, if we're thoughtful about it, Purim and the Megillah also highlight the question of just how Jewish we wish to be, and just how public we want to be about our Judaism. In the Book of Esther, events ultimately require the heroine, Queen Esther herself, to declare her Jewish identity. But first, she hides it, with the full knowledge and even the instruction to do so coming from her mentor and uncle, Mordechai. Only under duress does she affirm her Judaism and proudly proclaim it to her non-Jewish spouse. In this, we have another lesson. When Jews do step forward and assert pride in our own heritage, we are saved and achieve greatness. Had Esther and Mordechai not done so, they would have disappeared, as we would have all. Perhaps we too here in America can learn that lesson. a committed dedication to our own Judaism, a willingness to proclaim it and support it, no matter our own marital situation, are essential to our thriving, both individually and collectively. It's quite a message for what we too often think of as, oh, just a kid's holiday. It's quite a message for what we too often think of as, oh, just a kid's holiday. So no matter how old or young you are, or if you have or don't have your own kids, our strong Too Jewish recommendation is that you come to Purim this year. This morning, March 20th, my own congregation, Temple Emmanuel, here in Tucson, Arizona, where I live, performs a spectacular parody of the musical The Book of Mormon called The Book of Esther, complete with songs, costumes, sets, and dance. And then this Wednesday night, March 23rd, we chant the Megillah itself, the whole Megillah. Come to my Reform Synagogue, Temple Emmanuel, and have a wholesome and extremely good time. Well, fairly wholesome. And then go to an Orthodox one if you want and party all night, as they tend to. And don't miss the Great Purim Carnivals either for a traditional or non-traditional Humantash, best pastry of all. To play us in on this Purim theme, here's Mark Bloom's jazzy version of the classic Chag Purim.
Chag Purim, Chag Supreme, where grown-ups and kids all act like Yeladim. Exciting Ad Lo Yada, reciting Al HaNissim. It's a funky, funky holiday, this Chag Purim. As long as I remember those winters of my youth, 2 months past December and those carnival booths, I'd strut around dressed up like Mordecai, I recall, and check out all the cute Queen Esters like it was a fancy costume ball. Chag Purim, Chag Supreme, where grown-ups and kids all act like Yeladim. Exciting Ad Lo Yada, reciting Al HaNissim. It's a funky, funky holiday, it's Chag Purim. I really crank the grogger when I hear that Haman's name. The noise keeps getting stronger, he's the one to blame. Whether shaped just like his ear or shaped just like his hat, I gobble down the Humantash and baby, they're the greatest snack. Oh, Chag Purim, Chag Supreme, where grown-ups and kids all act like Yeladim. Exciting Ad Lo Yada, reciting Al HaNissim. It's a funky, funky holiday, this Chag Purim. Lesson from this quite amazing triumph of a crime is that we should not boast when our enemies have lost. For God might be displeased, we must remember who's the boss. Chag Purim, Chag Supreme, where grown-ups and kids all act like Yeladim. Exciting Ad Lo Yada, reciting Al HaNissim. It's a funky, funky holiday, a honky-tonky legacy. To Esther's funky victory, it's Chag Purim. It's all in the Megillah, the story's such a thriller. Purim.
That was Mark Bloom's jazz version of Chag Purim. Our guest this morning on Too Jewish, Ron Lieber, has been educating smart people weekly about their finances in his column in the New York Times called Your Money. His best-selling new book explains how to do just that with your own children. It's called The Opposite of Spoiled, Raising Kids Who Are Grounded, Generous, and Smart About Money. Meet him and find out how to do that when we return in a moment here on Too Jewish.
Are you or a loved one facing a terminal illness? Casa de la Luz Hospice offers patients and loved ones the support necessary to face the final months of life. Paid for by Medicare and most private insurances, hospice team members provide medical, emotional, and spiritual care in the security and comfort of the patient's home. Casa de la Luz has been a leading provider of hospice care in Tucson since 1998 and today serves more patients in Pima County than any other local hospice provider. The mission of Casa de la Luz Hospice is to provide superior care to patients and their loved ones so that they may complete their mission on this earth in comfort, dignity, and harmony. Call 544-9890 to learn more about how Casa de la Luz Hospice can help you. That's 544-9890. Casa de la Luz Hospice, because every day counts.
Hi, I'm Ben, a student at Tucson Hebrew Academy. Attention Arizona taxpayers, you can provide Jewish education to families at no cost to you. Direct your Arizona state tax dollars to JETCO, the Jewish Education Tax Credit Organization, and help make great Jewish education affordable. Here's how it works. Arizona lets taxpayers receive a dollar-for-dollar tax credit for payments made to JETCO. JETCO gives scholarships to kids who attend private schools like Anshe Israel's Kindergarten and Tucson Hebrew Academy, serving students from K-8. Tax credits are different from a tax deduction. When you give to JETCO, you get a 100% tax credit. That means your Arizona state income tax is reduced by the exact amount you've given. You can give up to $1,067 for a single filer and $2,134 for a married couple. You get that whole amount back from your state income tax. Give JETCO a call at 647-8442. That's 647-8442, or go to JETCO.org. You can even choose a future date to process your payment. How cool is that? Make a tax credit contribution to JETCO and build Jewish identity in Tucson for generations of students, and it won't cost you a dime.
We are delighted to welcome to Two Jewish This Morning our guest this morning. Ron Lieber is the author of the New York Times Your Money column and a wonderful book called The Opposite of Spoiled, a New York Times bestseller about how to raise kids who are grounded, generous, smart about money, and, well, I'd say moral as well. Good morning and welcome to Two Jewish.
Thank you so much for having me.
So what prompted you to write this book?
Well, there were a couple things that happened, but I'd say the thing that hit me hardest was when my three-year-old, my firstborn, started asking really complicated questions about money, questions that I could not answer, despite the fact that I play Dr. Money in the newspaper on the weekend for the New York Times. And I knew her questions were about more than just dollars and cents. The questions that she was asking were deep and searching. She was trying to figure out what it was that we stood for, how it was that we made the big grown-up decisions that had an impact on her, even at the age of three, even if she could not quite articulate the depth of her curiosity or where exactly it was springing from. And I knew I needed to figure it out, and that was the origin of the journey that I ultimately went on.
You know, I think that parents are less scared about talking about sex with their kids than they are about talking about money. Is that an inaccurate thought?
No, I think you've got it exactly right. You know, the sex talk isn't easy either, but there's a biological imperative to talking about sex. If you don't talk about sex, and, you know, things are going to start happening to your children's bodies that are going to be inexplicable unless you or somebody else explains them. So you don't really have a choice in the matter at the end of the day. But when it comes to money, parents quite often convince themselves that money talk is impolite or impolitic or impractical, that kids are not ready for money talks until they're grown up, or that the conversation is something that they should just leave alone so that they can protect their kids a little bit longer from this sort of scary part of the world. And I don't buy it. I think there's a direct connection between talking about money and teaching kids values, and that's what I set out to prove, that that connection exists and that it's a crucial part of parenting.
I want to raise the question of allowances, which most of us have given our kids, and think that it has something to do with managing money. Does it really work like that?
I think it does. But, you know, I tend to frame allowance in a slightly different way than most people do. I see money as a teaching tool. Money is something that we want our kids to be good at, the same way we want them to get good at reading or to get good at whatever musical instrument they enjoy playing or whatever sport. And all of those things take practice. So allowance is for practice. And I don't think there should be any connection between getting allowance and the completion of chores. To me, chores are something that you do because you live in the household. And if we start connecting chores with allowance, you know, pretty soon we'll back ourselves into a negotiating corner that we really don't want to be in, right? Because there will come a point when our smart aleck older kids have enough money, say it got for a little while, and then they won't want to do the chores. So it's only for those practical reasons. I think those the allowance and chores really should not be connected.
We will talk much more about what it is to raise moral children in relationship to money, how to be grounded and smart about that when we come back with Ron Lieber in just a few moments here on Too Jewish. We welcome David and Pam of Freedom Smoke International, new sponsors here on Too Jewish. What is Freedom Smoke International?
Thank you, Rabbi Kohan. Freedom Smoke USA is an electronic cigarette company based right here out of Tucson. We were the first store in the United States, the first store to have all FDA-approved products. It's a healthier alternative to cigarette smoking.
No smoke, no tobacco, and doctors refer people to you.
That's correct. My doctor actually just gave me a glowing report from other patients he's had that I've been able to find this as a healthier alternative to smoking.
Cardiologists, pulmonologists, even dentists, huh?
That's correct. It does help with all that.
How many flavors can people get of this?
We have over 700 flavors available.
Where are the locations and how do people get connected?
Our first location is at River and Orange Grove. We opened one at Broadway and Swan, and we currently just had our grand opening at 12th and Valencia.
And we do have a store in Southern Michigan also.
And what phone number can people call?
You can call the toll-free number at 1-800-705-7013. That's freedomsmokeusa.com.
Thank you, and we'll talk some more next week. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kfel, please email us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com. That's twojewishradio18@gmail. Or visit our website at twojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website or download us at the Apple iTunes Store's very popular Jewish podcasts. Well, we're getting close to electing a new president of these United States. We continue our election year feature, the 2016 Two Jewish Presidential Report. And then there were more or less two. After the latest Super Day primary elections, Tuesday, Wednesday, Saturday, whatever the heck it was, Hillary Clinton won victories that put her well on track to defeat Bernie Sanders for the Democratic nomination, while Donald Trump is now far ahead of the rest of the Republican field. Marco Rubio pulled out of the Republican race, leaving Ted Cruz and John Kasich to contest Trump's nomination going forward. Interestingly, it appears that both Clinton and Trump may be indicted before the general election. Hillary for the email server issue at the State Department, and Trump for his defunct Trump University fraud case. From a Jewish perspective, it's hard to get excited about either Clinton or Trump, although Clinton's Israel bona fides appear more solid than Trump's mercurial relationship with pro-Israel advocates in his own party would lead us to believe. Many of us in the Jewish world, however, are still wondering how a guy like Donald Trump can be the likely nominee of a major party for president of the United States. That was our 2016 presidential election from a Jewish perspective update. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
We've been talking about the perception that anti-Semitism in Europe is on the rise, that it's become an untenable place for Jews. As we get close to the holiday of Purim, you know, it's always a good time to talk about people wanting to kill the Jews. These far-right parties that have arisen are mostly fringe elements, but often they're in response to the increased Muslim population, and they are opposed to the Muslims, who are also opposed to Israel and the Jews. And are the Jews stuck in the middle? Like, what's the experience for most Jews in Europe?
Well, that's an important point. A lot of the resurgent far-right parties don't have anti-Semitism as part of their platform. They may have nationalism as part of their platform. They may have, you know, Hungary for the Hungarians as part of their platform. But Jews have been an integral part of Hungarian life for centuries. And what, you know, if you boil it right down, a lot of the extreme right parties in Europe are basically against Muslims and other extremists who are disrupting law and order in a peaceful, predictable society. So in some ways, the extreme right-wing parties that Jews have learned historically to fear are actually emerging as a result of attacks on Jews. And the extreme right parties don't care one way or the other much about Israel and the Palestinians and issues outside their own countries. I mean, sort of like here, in fact, extreme right-wing elements are most concerned with domestic issues, not international issues, not Certainly. Issues of recognition of the Palestinian Authority, whatever. So, I mean, daily life for Jews in most places in Europe is fine. I mean, they consider themselves, you know, Danes first or Dutch first and Jews second. And that has not changed much over time. What I think has changed over time is something about the nature of what used to be anti-Judaism, and then starting in the 1400s, more or less, in Spain, morphed into anti-Semitism as we know it today. And that has changed in a way that I think is worth exploring, at least briefly. And what it has changed from is that for the first more than 1,000 years of the history of the Roman Catholic Church, and there was no other Christian church in Western Europe during that period until the 16th century. It was, you were Roman Catholic or you were nothing if you lived in Western Europe. The goal of the church in its relationship with the Jews was to try to get the Jews finally to recognize the divinity of Jesus or the fact that Jesus was Messiah or both. And Jews were in trouble when they were, because they refused to recognize those two things, not because of their blood or their lineage or their ancestry or anything else. And in many of those centuries, Jews could hold important positions at the royal court or whatever. I mean, Europe was a backward place, but there was still opportunity for certain Jews to prosper. I mean, the Rothschild family did not start accumulating its fortune in the last century. Goes way back. Sure. And there were these Hofjuden who always took advantage of the system. That changed and brought an element of modern danger to Jewish life at two significant periods, which I guess we'll explore next week.
Thanks, Tom. We'll talk then. And Chag Sameach. We welcome our Mivinah in Israel, Oshrat Barel, head of the Wine Tribe Israel Center. Boker Tov, Oshrat.
Boker Tov, Rabbi.
Chag Purim Sameach.
Chag Sameach.
Happy Holiday of Purim coming up this week. We're celebrating at Temple Emmanuel on this very morning. Purim in Israel used to be everybody dressed as Mordechai and Haman and Esther.
No, no Haman.
No,
Mordechai
well,
and
I
Queen
saw,
Esther.
I saw the masks.
Really?
Yeah, I did. Maybe it was only, you know, the dark children that
I want to see
Haman.
The parents.
Yeah. They chose which kid was going to be Haman, I'm sure. Apparently they don't dress like that anymore.
No, it was funny because from Hanukkah I got like from phone calls from Ellie's my husband sister, my sister-in-law's, send us costume of Anna Elsa. Actually, from the Halloween, they asked for us if there is any leftover costumes of Anna and Elsa.
This is from the movie Frozen, the Disney Frozen, movie from a like, few years ago that has now taken over the whole world.
Yeah, definitely. So the world is now by Anna, Elsa, and Olaf. You are one of the three of them or you are nothing.
Oh my gosh.
So Purim, we will see tons of Anna and Elsa and Olaf, and that's it.
That's the Disneyfication of Israel.
I don't know, there is one parent that will be brave enough to send their kids as Queen Esther.
Queen Esther.
Or Mordechai, yeah.
Oy vey. So, okay, how far can we be from Disney Tel Aviv coming as the new version of Disneyland? Now, Purim in Israel is crazy fun. There's parties everywhere, people walking around the streets, they spray silly string on each other, mm-hmm. they bop each other on the head with noisemakers. People fulfill that commandment to drink Ad Lo Yada. Right. Actually,
one of the beautiful things in Israel for Purim is the parades.
Oh.
The parades are not parades as you can think about like Brazil, or the parades are usually all the different carts, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
Like
so not floats, like
all kind of tracks,
But each track is decorated by different youth movement. Like Bnei Akiva will have one.
So it's like a socialist leftover kind of from the days of the kibbutzim and the
moshavim.
You know
what? I think that it's kind of Shavuot, but you know, a combination of Shavuot
and Purim.
But it's lovely because every youth movement will have a theme, and they will have some of them big dolls or any decoration, uh-huh. and they will have an Ad Lo Yada. That's how, I don't know if they know why they call it Ad Lo Yada, because Ad Lo Yada relates to
something. You're supposed to drink, so you
else,
can't tell just between Haman and Mordechai.
Yeah,
and,
but that's how
Jews
they
don't
call
drink
it.
So much generally, but on Purim we
so
do.
That's why they choose to have a parade instead of drinking.
So it's a very good, virtuous parade with lots of decorations. It's kind of like the Israeli...
I promise to learn why it from drinking became parade. I'll learn it for next Purim.
Please tell me by next year, if you can remember, because you might not know by then. Thanks so much, Oshrat.
Toda, Rabbi.
Is your aging loved one unhappy and having a hard time adjusting to life around them? The TMC Geropsychiatric Center at Handmaker may be able to help. TMC Geropsych specializes in providing short-term inpatient services for older adults experiencing behavioral health issues. Did you know that most people with depression get better when they seek help? With the right treatment, those with anxiety can overcome and learn to cope with their fears, and individuals with dementia can continue leading quality lives. Our team, led by a geriatric psychiatrist, brings expertise from disciplines across a variety of specialties to ensure your loved one receives the right diagnosis and treatment. For more information about our services, please call 324-4600. The TMC Geropsychiatric Center at Handmaker. Call 324-4600. Let's talk about how we can help.
We welcome our maven on Jewish education, John Ben Asher, head of the Tucson Hebrew Academy. Good morning, John. Boker Tov.
Boker Tov.
We've been talking about the different ages and how students need different things or different
yes.
needs. Let's talk about some of the older kids, high
sure.
school kids up into college. We were joking about how school prepares you for everything except life.
Right. That's where experience kicks in, right?
Indeed.
My mom was fond of saying, you know, your degree and 50 cents will buy you a cup of coffee, but I guess that's not,
not anymore,
true today.
Not at Starbucks.
Yeah. Well, you know, we've been talking a little bit about Maslow's hierarchy of needs and Bloom's taxonomy, and they're very different. One talks about the psychological needs of people, and that's Maslow, and it comes from the basics of physiological needs like sleep,
food, clothing, shelter.
Shelter, and then all the way up to self-actualization, being your best self, living a fulfilled life. And Bloom's taxonomy talks about levels of learning and how you apply knowledge and learning. And so these things are in play, whether or not we're talking about kindergarten students, 12th graders, or lifelong learners. Certainly applies to students in college and adult learning as well. There's a base of knowledge, and when you build on that base, then there's a level of comprehension, understanding. Moving up the chart, we have application, where you can apply the learning. And then there's analysis, when you start to really make connections in the mind and thinking in a deep way and an analytical, critical way about what you've learned. And then there's the synthesis level, where you bring it all together, where you're creating from the knowledge that you've learned, where you're developing new ideas. And then at the top of the pyramid there is evaluation, when you're able to think back and reflect and think critically about something and maybe look to do better the next time. I think that at the Tucson Hebrew Academy, our eighth grade trip at the end of the year to Israel really encapsulates that sense of what's at the top of the pyramid. Kids have spent many, many years building a knowledge base, applying the learning, wrestling with concepts, debating, challenging, talking with Rabbi Billy and their other teachers about heavy ideas, powerful ideas in Judaism. And then they get to go to Israel and see it all and live it. And there's really a major synthesis of how everything comes together. And it takes this huge leap of knowledge and experience when they go on this trip. So it's exciting to see how the taxonomy and how Maslow's hierarchy play out in the developmental stages at school.
And how they come together in something experiential, but also educational, like a trip to Israel. It's an amazing
Absolutely.
Experience.
Absolutely.
John, thanks so much. We will talk next week. Chag Sameach. Happy Purim.
Chag Sameach, everybody.
When we return on To Jewish, we'll hear the old Jewish joke of the week.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
We welcome John Ben Asher, head of school for Tucson Hebrew Academy. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Rabbi Kohan.
Tell us about THA.
THA is an incredible school, rich community, strong educational culture. We're a K-8 program and Tucson's only Jewish day school.
With small classes, really a tremendous level of individual attention.
Absolutely. Our engaging, talented faculty ensure a rigorous, interactive, supporting learning environment for kids.
And those kids go on to succeed academically. This isn't just about Jewish identity.
THA graduates go on to Tucson's best high schools, and they are exceptionally well prepared.
And I've seen some of them go to Ivy League schools, some of the best colleges in the country too, if that's important for parents, which I believe it is.
That's right. THA really paves the way for students. A rich, strong academic foundation, as well as Jewish knowledge, learning, and culture.
And great community. How can people find out more about putting their kids in THA?
You can come visit or find us online, thaaz.org, and give us a call, 529-3888.
That's 529-3888, or visit www.thaaz.org. Temple Emmanuel pilgrimage trip to Israel with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, is leaving May 29th to June 9th, 2016. If you want to go on this fabulous journey to Israel, seeing it all from Tel Aviv to Haifa to Tzfat to the Sea of Galilee to amazing Jerusalem, email tojewishradio18 at gmail.com or call 520-327-4501 for more information and an itinerary. It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week, Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. A congregant comes up to a rabbi at the Oneg Shabbat and says, "Rabbi, that was the worst sermon I ever heard. You insulted our intelligence and you rambled on and on." A congregant, another one, overhears her, approaches the rabbi and says, "Ah, don't listen to her. She doesn't have a mind of her own. She just repeats what everybody else is saying." That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. This week's portion is second in the book of Leviticus, Tzav, a section that establishes the rules for the various sacrifices offered in the tabernacle in the wilderness, the Mishkan, later to be repeated in the temple in Jerusalem. There are many different types of sacrifices commanded, burnt offerings, guilt offerings, sin offerings, and so on. But one group of sacrificial offerings stands out, the offerings of peace, the Zevach Shlamim. Among this higher category of offerings, one in particular rises higher still, the Zevach Todah, the thanksgiving offering. The rabbis thought so highly of thanksgiving to God that they are quoted in the Talmud saying that when the Messiah comes, all sacrifices will have completed their mission and be discontinued with one exception, the thanksgiving offering. That sacrifice will last forever, because even in a perfect world, we must remember to give thanks and be grateful for what we have. As we approach the holiday of Pesach, we do well to remember that gratitude for what we have is both the most essential of all religious motivations and the hardest to keep in mind. If we can each take a moment today to write, text, email, or phone our thanks to someone who's important in our lives, we'll begin to renew this great commitment of our Torah portion of Tzav. We have so much in our lives for which we can be grateful. And if we can also take a moment to thank God for what we have and to be more conscious of those who have less, well, then we will begin to make this a better world. For thanksgiving should not lead us to complacency, but to humility and gratitude. When we come back on Too Jewish, our guest, Ron Lieber, the Your Money columnist with the New York Times, will explain what led him to write his best-selling new book on how to raise children who are responsible, generous, and smart about money, and how bar and bat mitzvahs factor into all of that. Find out when we return shortly here on Too Jewish.
Hi, Doris. How are you?
Well, Carol, to be honest, now that I'm a little older, I can't get out as much as I'd like. I'm miss seeing people.
Why don't you come over to my place for lunch on us? The food's delicious. So many choices. And I have a special table with my friends every day. They'd love to have you join us.
Is there much to do there?
There are lots of activities every day. Mondays is Mahjong. Tuesdays I do yoga. Wednesdays we go shopping or to the museum or a restaurant. Thursdays my exercise class. There are book groups, speakers, Shabbos services, concerts, a game room. I'm busier than ever.
Where do you live?
I'm at Handmaker. And the people are great. Please come over for lunch. You'll love it. It's even kosher. Just call me at 322-7035.
Handmaker Jewish Services for the Aging offers the full spectrum of quality senior living and post-hospital rehabilitative care. Call 322-7035. Handmaker for life. 322-7035.
Are you or a loved one facing a terminal illness? Casa de la Luz Hospice offers patients and loved ones the support necessary to face the final months of life. Paid for by Medicare and most private insurances, hospice team members provide medical, emotional, and spiritual care in the security and comfort of the patient's home. Casa de la Luz has been a leading provider of hospice care in Tucson since 1998, and today serves more patients in Pima County than any other local hospice provider. The mission of Casa de la Luz Hospice is to provide superior care to patients and their loved ones so that they may complete their mission on this earth in comfort, dignity, and harmony. Call 544-9890 to learn more about how Casa de la Luz Hospice can help you. That's 544-9890. Casa de la Luz Hospice, because every day counts.
We continue with our Two Jewish Update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
President Barack Obama selected Merrick Garland for the U.S. Supreme Court last week, choosing a centrist Jewish judge meant to win over recalcitrant Senate Republicans whose leaders wasted no time spurning the Democratic president. Garland, who is 63 years old, was picked to replace long-serving conservative Justice Antonin Scalia, who died suddenly back on February 13th. Garland, the Chicago native, serves as a chief judge of the influential U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit. He's a former prosecutor who's won praise from both Republicans and Democrats. He would be the fourth Jewish jurist on the nine-judge panel. There are now five Catholics and zero Protestants. Jews make up less than 2% of the total population of the United States. Wow. A bruising political fight is looming over Garland's nomination, however, with the Republican-led Senate's leaders vowing not to hold confirmation hearings or an up-and-down vote on any Obama nominee. Senate is insisting the appointment should be delayed until the next president is elected. This lifetime appointment requires Senate confirmation. Republicans, hoping a candidate from their party win the November 8th presidential election, are demanding Obama leave the seat vacant and let his successor, who won't be sworn in until next January, make the selection. Businessman and former reality TV star Donald Trump leads among Republicans for the nomination. Obama's former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton is, of course, the frontrunner on the Democratic side. At a ceremony in the White House Rose Garden, Obama said that if Republican senators refuse to give Garland a fair hearing, it will not only be an abdication of the Senate's constitutional duty, it will indicate a process for nominating and confirming judges that is beyond repair. Obama said such a move would undermine the reputation of the Supreme Court and faith in the American system of justice. Our democracy will ultimately suffer, he added. Garland is widely viewed as a moderate. He's a former prosecutor. He served in the Justice Department under Bill Clinton. He oversaw the prosecution in the 1995 Oklahoma City bombing case, including securing the death penalty for the lead defendant, anti-government militant, well, terrorist, Timothy McVeigh. In his current post, the Jewish jurist is known for a narrow, centrist point of view and rhetoric that is measured rather than inflammatory. The Labour Party in Britain has suspended a member for the second time for saying Jews have big noses and slaughter the oppressed. Nice. Vicky Kirby, a former parliamentary candidate, was suspended last week. Her comments in old tweets resurfaced after she was made a local vice chair of the party last week. Other tweets claim that Hitler might be the Zionist God and that she would make sure to have her kids teach their children how evil Israel is. Kirby originally was suspended from the Labour Party in 2014, but was later readmitted and recently was appointed vice chairman of Labour's branch in Woking, a town in the southeast in Surrey. Party leader Jeremy Corbyn has been under fire for allowing this appointment. Several party members brought up the issue at a parliamentary meeting last week. Senior Labour leader Louise Ellman said relations between the Labour Party and the British Jewish community have hit rock bottom. The party announced Kirby's suspension hours after the meeting. Corbyn himself, the shadow prime minister under the British system, has long been associated with anti-Israel elements in British politics and internationally. People like Paul Eisen, a Holocaust denier, whose foundation Deir Yassin remembered Corbyn supports, Raed Salah, a Palestinian leader convicted of funding Hamas, whom Corbyn invited to parliament and called a very honored citizen, and Arab activist Diab Abu Jaja, with whom Corbyn shared a platform at a coalition meeting in 2009, but who was later banned from the UK on grounds of extremism and terrorism. Corbyn, the Labour leader again, also referred to Hamas and Hezbollah as friends during a parliamentary meeting on the Middle East. He's met with representatives of both Hamas and Hezbollah in Lebanon. Hamas and Hezbollah are recognized as terrorist organizations by the European Union. Cheerful stuff. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews Around the World. We welcome back to Two Jewish. Our guest this morning, Ron Lieber, is the Your Money columnist for the New York Times. Before joining the Times, he wrote for the Wall Street Journal and a variety of other publications. He's an expert on finance, but his new book is called The Opposite of Spoiled, Raising Kids Who Are Grounded, Generous, and Smart About Money. You address a variety of the kinds of questions that parents deal with. How much of this is autobiographical from your own experience working with your kids?
Well, I think it can't help but be autobiographical. I think we're all formed by the experiences we had growing up, and then we're all formed by the experiences we have as parents if we become parents. So, you know, for me, the autobiographical part of this comes from the fact that I sort of rode the, you know, social class roller coaster over time. There was an incident, kind of, you know, in middle school, more than an incident, really a sort of fracturing of my family's financial situation, and that caused me to, go from being one of the kids who had more than average to being one of the kids who got scholarship help everywhere he went. And, that made me all the more curious, not only about money, but, about the people who had more than average and how they didn't always know how good they have it, or didn't really stop to think about, what it was like to have to make choices or trade-offs. And I learned a lot from the process of kind of having a front row seat for applying for financial aid. I grew up to be, the young adult who spent a lot of my time trying to figure out how to, exploit loopholes in various financial systems to always try and be the sort of unprofitable customer. I have an obsession with frequent flyer miles and games and systems and schemes like that. And it was only in my 30s when the Wall Street Journal got their claws into me that they made me realize that I could do that for a living. I could be the person who's beat, whose area of coverage was beating the system. And once they helped me understand that, it opened a whole bunch of doors and windows for me. And, when my daughter started asking these difficult questions, I realized that there was an opportunity to take the things that she was asking and turn it into journalism, turn it into a quest to figure out the right way to answer her questions, such that I'd be making connections for her between what we spend and what we save and what we give to and how much and what it is that we stand for.
You know, there was a time when my wife said to me, I think our oldest son is getting to be spoiled. And it was a kind of a revelation When I was growing up, I didn't have a whole lot of stuff. We didn't have much money. I never missed anything that I can remember, but I wanted to give more to my kids. Is that a natural problem? We seem to have found a way to correct it, I think, but that's probably not an unusual experience.
Well, the challenge that I think many parents have who, you know, take a leap up the social class ladder from one generation to the next is that they want very much for their kids to have the best of everything, to want for nothing, to not have to struggle, to not have to be one of the kids who, you know, doesn't have the thing that all the other kids want. And, you know, that's a natural instinct. And it's much harder, you know, to be the parent who is constantly pulling back and employing or deploying what the sociologists refer to as enforced or artificial deprivation. But, you know, whenever the word comes up, and I slapped that word spoiled on the cover of my book for a reason. It's a visceral term. It makes people uncomfortable, I think in part because it's a verb, right? Spoiled by whom? Well, you know, usually these kids are spoiled by their parents. It's a failure of parenting. And I think, you know, you need to define for yourself what it is that word means. Quite often for parents, it's a synonym for materialism or entitlement. But, you know, it's also the case that spoiled kids are kids who have no rules or there's no consequences for breaking the rules, for whom, you know, the path is constantly smoothed over and, you know, they're not allowed to fail and they're constantly being sort of picked up and brushed off. So you don't have to have a lot of money to spoil a child, although it can help.
What do you say, and you do this in the book kind of extensively, when your son or daughter says, how much money do you make, Dad? How much money do you make, Mom?
Sure. So, you know, the questions are going to come fast and furious. And I think the most important thing for parents to realize before anything else is that these questions are natural, right? Money is a source of great power in the world, but it's also a source of mystery because grownups don't talk about it very much and they try and dodge the question. So, you know, if we're in the grown-up making business here as parents, it's only natural that our kids are going to be curious about this, so we can't shoo them away. So, you know, my response to any of those questions is always to look right back with a sort of expression of wonder and appreciation and say, huh, why do you ask? Because quite often, take the salary question, for instance, that, you know, the kids who are, you know, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, they don't have the, you know, math skills to really, do the math on a, you know, 5 or 6 figure salary. The kids who are older, they may have the math skills, but they don't have the context. They don't understand what it takes financially to, you know, put together a monthly budget and shell out for all of the things that a family might need, in any given 4 week span. So answering that question, the salary question, with a number is probably not going to teach them very much. Now, I do think kids ought to know. In fact, I think they're entitled to know. I think we ought to tell them what the number is by the time they graduate from high school so they can get a sense of, you know, what it takes to provide the kind of life that they have become accustomed to wherever they are in the social class scale. But before then, I think there need to be a lot of family discussions about, allowance and spending and saving and giving, giving the kids lots of practice with ever larger numbers, and also bringing them in over the course of several years on all of the aspects of the family budget. Because until they've done all those things, they can't really make heads or tails of some random number on the bottom of a 1040 form.
You know, for many Jewish parents, the Bar Bat Mitzvah is not only like a wedding, it becomes kind of an orgy of presents and materialism. In your book, you talk about the sort of famous viral Sam Horowitz, incredible, this kid was famous at the age of 13, a video of a really totally over-the-top bar mitzvah party. How, you know, this is a crucial sort of question. How materialistic a bar mitzvah should it be?
Well, this is a tough one, right? Because if you're lucky enough to have the means to ask that question in the first place, you probably have, you know, all along throughout their childhood, been saying no to certain things. So, you know, one tactic I might recommend is, using that same strategy with the bar bat mitzvah where you set, a reasonable budget, but not a budget so high that you don't have to make some hard choices. some trade-offs. That's what grown-ups do in their everyday life and their everyday budgeting. And, you know, by all means, bring the kid in on the conversation so that they know how much you're spending, and so that the, you know, they can make some of the choices and the trade-offs themselves. Now, you know, the right number is going to be different in different communities, and, you know, I don't advocate picking one or another. I do know a number of parents who've had success saying, look, you know, we had hoped to spend whatever it is, you know, $15,000 on your bar mitzvah party. If you would like, we can take that money and go on a family trip to wherever you want in the world. Or we can go on a family trip that doesn't cost quite as much, but you can bring six friends along. And we'll do that instead of, you know, having the same party with the same music and the same whatever. And quite often the kids will make that choice. And so, you know, if you provide some reasonable alternatives, you can dodge the whole thing.
Yeah, kind of. The bar mitzvah safari to Africa doesn't impress me as so much less materialistic than the big hotel, you know, event at the polo club. speaking as a rabbi here, but also somebody who's put on three bar mitzvahs for his own kids. Is there some way of addressing that question in a way that highlights the values of it?
Sure. You know, you might do what an increasing number of congregations have done, you know, following on, you know, something that started at the, what used to be called the Brandeis Hillel Day School in San Francisco, now known as the Brandeis School. Right. You know, they did something with gifts. You know, they basically decided the school realized that there wasn't much they could do to, you know, legislate the parties. And they were all very high-minded up there. They said, you know, we don't have the same problems with ostentatiousness as they do in L.A., but, you know, this gift thing seems sort of ridiculous, right? You know, it's 40, 50, 60 kids in the seventh grade class each year, and they're all buying $15 or $20 trinkets, you know, each and every weekend, sometimes twice for these parties. And they decided that they should take all of the money that they were spending on gifts for one another and just throw it into a giant pile and give it away. And this became a phenomenon that grew so large that they eventually rebuilt the entire seventh grade curriculum around what's now known as the seventh grade fund, which, you know, now runs to, you know, $25,000 a year. They've literally got a foundation there, and, you know, grown-ups in suits and ties and dresses, you know, come to meet with them each year to beg them for a chunk of the money. You know, you might do the same thing with the gifts, the cash gifts that your child gets. You know, maybe, you know, if you're unwilling to, I mean, look, there's a plenty good case to be made for, you know, toning down the party and using part of that budget for a philanthropic venture. But, you know, if you're not prepared to do that, or if you, you know, want your child to have a party not unlike what other kids are having, you can certainly do something with the gifts that's over and above and beyond the sort of, you know, standard issue mitzvah project, something that's, you know, more meaningful and sizable.
You know, it's funny. It doesn't end when kids go off to college, does it? My son called me, or he said, I'm going to get a new laptop, Dad. I said, well, you know, what's wrong with the laptop you got 2 years ago? Well, it doesn't play games well enough, and I have enough money in the bank to do it. It's an uncomfortable conversation. That kind of thing happens, doesn't it?
Yes. And, you know, you have to make a decision as a parent about what it is that's going to be on your banned item list. You know, I've never heard of a parent who has put a, you know, new laptop on a banned item list. And, you know, the fact of the matter is that if the kid has saved the money fair and square, you know, you're sort of hard-pressed to say to that kid, you know, no, that's not an appropriate expenditure. I mean, you could try and, you know, talk him out of it. You could, you know, check back in with him, you know, 3, 6, 12 months later to see if he feels regret, if there's something else that he would have rather spent the money on. But, you know, if that's the thing that he's passionate about and he's earned and saved the money fair and square, then I think you're in a tough spot.
I want to thank Ron Lieber for a great visit here. By the way, laptops are not on the banned item list, I agree. But we had a very interesting conversation. The book is called The Opposite of Spoiled, Raising Kids Who Are Grounded, Generous, and Smart About Money. It's an excellent, helpful, wonderful way to begin to broach some challenging subjects in a good way and in a constructive way. Thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
Is there a website people can go to find out some more?
Sure. My website is ronlieber.com, L-I-E-B as in boy, E-R.
Thanks so much. When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest and get a final musical play out.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday on Too Jewish. Our guest will be legendary AP reporter Mort Rosenblum discussing the state of the media today. Our playout this morning comes for Purim, arriving in a few minutes at Temple Emmanuel with a great parody of the Book of Mormon called the Book of Esther right after Too Jewish is done today. It'll be followed by a carnival. This Wednesday evening, enjoy a traditional Megillah reading at 6:30 p.m. at Temple Emmanuel. This song is a Sephardic Purim song from Tangier called Kichlot Yeni from the group The Voice of the Turtle. My friends, may you have a Shavua Tov, a Chag Purim Sameach, a happy holiday of Purim, and a week, we pray, of peace. Kichlot Yeni Tereheni, Kichlot Yeni Tereheni, Kichlot Yeni
Tereheni, Al Gemayim, Al Gemayim. Sponsored by Two Jewish Radio Programs, Tucson, Arizona.